You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Saturday, August 15th, 2015, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
Hi, New York.
We are here at LICON 2, the Long Island Convention, only the second one to have ever occurred.
I checked the math. That's accurate.
Is that accurate? So there may be people here who haven't listened to the show before, who don't know who we are or what we do. This is something funny I found on the internet, put it on our Facebook page. It's somebody holding up a protest sign that says, "What do we want? Evidence-based change. When do we want it? After peer review."
That's awesome.
Which is awesome. But if you're inside, it's awesome. But it does, I think, reveal the fact that as activists, skeptics, critical thinkers, science enthusiasts, we often have a difficult time focusing our message in a very pithy and emotional way. It's hard to get really riled up about after peer review, you know. But that's what we do, you know. So this actually very short phrase contains sort of the two of the things that we advocate. One is, you know, basing your opinions on actual scientific evidence. And the other is having a process, going through an actual formal process of trying to figure out what's actually real and what's maybe not so likely to be real. And it's not sexy, it's not pithy, but it is, I think, the only way to really arrive at an understanding of the very complicated universe that we live in that has any real validity to it.
I would add to that being humble enough to know that your memory is faulty and that your own analysis are faulty.
Yes. I call that neuropsychological humility, which basically means having a good understanding of the fact that your brain really sucks. It's powerful. Our brains are powerful. We have actually, in a lot of ways, it's a massive parallel processor. We could recognize things, recognize patterns very well.
Too well.
But it's also, it's overwhelmed with bias and perception. We actually construct a narrative of reality that suits our emotional needs, and then we really stick to it very carefully. So, but you can transcend all of that with just a little critical thinking. That's, I guess, our message.
Yep.
So we start the show typically with this is one of our newer segments this year, but I think it's been very popular, Forgotten Superheroes of Science.
Yes, for this week in Forgotten Superheroes of Science, I'm covering Francis Kelsey, who was a pharmacologist and a physician who was instrumental in preventing the crippling drug thalidomide from being sold in the United States. Now, thalidomide, I'm sure a lot of you have heard about it. It was a drug with multiple uses, but at that time, over half a century ago, it was primarily used for treating nausea in pregnant women, and it had been released in Canada and about 20 other European countries. And Francis Kelsey was a drug reviewer for the FDA, and a company, the William S. Merrill Company in Cincinnati, was trying to sell it in the United States, and she kept pushing them back. She was saying that, look, I've gone over some of the experiments that you've done and some of the studies, and I'm seeing some unusual, like, nerve issues with some of the people that were studied. I need you to look at that more closely and do some more studies. But the people, representatives from the Merrill Company were like, they went to her boss, they said that she was a petty bureaucrat, and they were complaining to her boss, and she was very strong about it. She kept pushing back, saying, no, I'm not going to approve this drug until I'm satisfied. And she pushed back for about 19 months, so over a year and a half she was pushing back
just
on this.
Just long enough.
Just long enough, because right at that time, after 19 months, the results were coming in all these countries. Thousands and thousands of children were being born with crippling deformities. I think the classic manifestation would be, maldevelopment of arms and legs. It'd be like flippers. Your arms were just these like little flippers, really deformed and terrible.
Yeah,
and
it kept limbs from fully growing. So you would have just like a limb bud or nothing. And that's it. So yeah, people were being born essentially without functioning limbs.
So basically, was it turning off the genes that would otherwise?
It was a genetic effect, regulation of the genes that would kick in to make the limb grow. Right. Yeah.
And what I did not know is that a lot, a significant percentage of these kids actually died. I thought they were just deformed and had to live in that state, but they were like 40 to 50% of these kids actually died, so the death toll was even higher. I think the final number was like 10,000 of babies were born with this. She was instrumental in preventing this from happening in the United States, and she received many honors. The Washington Post described her as a heroine, front page article. She said, Kelsey was a heroine whose skepticism and stubbornness prevented what could have been an appalling American tragedy. John F. Kennedy actually gave her the President's Award for Distinguished Federal Civilian Service. She was the second woman to ever receive that. And actually, another thing I didn't realize is that there were some, in the wake of this, there were drug regulations that were passed by the FDA, which were very important, such as the Kefauver-Harris Amendment, which passed unanimously in Congress in October 1962. So the effects were actually good for this, at least for the FDA. And she died August 7th at 101. So she only recently
just
died.
Just this year?
A week ago.
Oh my gosh. An amazing, that's a hell of 101. That's amazing.
It's a good run.
Wow. Yes. So remember, So remember Frances Kelsey. Maybe mention her to your friends, perhaps when you're discussing anti-angiogenic and oxidative stress-inducing effects. If it ever comes up.
Yeah.
What's ironic is that the case of thalidomide is often thrown in my face as a failure of regulations to protect the public from drug side effects.
Hello.
I know, it's like, no, actually, they totally get the story wrong. It's like that happened in Europe and didn't happen in the United States because of the FDA.
Right.
So they completely get the, but, you know, again, within alternative medicine or what anti-mainstream medicine circles, this has become a story with the exact opposite lesson of the truth.
Incredible.
Which is,
And regulations, at least in the United States, were even stronger after it, even though it did not affect us.
Yeah, obviously, it's not perfect. The regulatory system is not perfect. We're always trying to balance protecting the public, but not impeding progress, right? Getting drugs out there. Which is funny. I also get people push back saying, oh, the FDA is slowing down, you know, the adoption of new drugs to people who really need it. It's like, yeah, remember thalidomide. You know, that delay saves a lot of lives too. It's not perfect. Vioxx and other things still get through. You can't know what's going to happen to a million people until you give it to a million people. But, we need that layer of protection in there.
Until we can simulate a million people in a computer, but that's a little ways away.
Yeah, more than 5 or 10
ways
away.
Yeah.
5 years?
Yeah. 10 years.
Jay.
Yes.
You're going to tell us how we can get our ass to Mars.
This is something that NASA's doing. They're creating in Hawaii, a simulation of astronauts living on Mars for a year. So they're creating a habitat, and they're also telling them the protocol is...
Is there going to be like a little wheel in there that they could run around and tubes that
they can crawl through? Exercise, so yeah.
Somebody's got to charge the batteries.
But if they leave the habitat into the outer area, they have to put on a spacesuit, and they're going to be making them do a lot of the tasks or tons of the tasks that would be needed in order for them to be on Mars legitimately. And the goal of this mission, if they choose to take it, is to test it out and throw scenarios at them to see what happens and see, you know, they'll come up with protocols for things because we've never been to Mars before. Yeah.
Because that's the thing that you can do on Earth. You could lock people in a small, confined space, pretend they're on Mars.
Yeah.
Right? You can do that.
It doesn't matter.
I know, it's been done, but this is taking it to the next step. It doesn't matter that there really isn't a horrible environment outside their capsule. They could pretend that there is.
Practice. So they're essentially like astronaut LARPing.
Yes.
Yes, that's right. In 1G, yes.
But gravity is the thing. That is the only thing. Yeah.
Now, because I personally believe that a legitimate Mars mission is way off, you know, I don't think we're going to do it in a decade. I think we're...
Well, NASA's saying, like, they'll start launching stuff in the 2030s, which probably means the 2050s, if we're being realistic.
I think that sounds more legitimate.
Assuming we don't destroy ourselves by then.
It's great that they're doing this, because these are the first tests that we're going to do that are going to bring up interesting things like food production, like waste removal, atmosphere management, radiation protection... And then the stir-crazy factor, which is starting to come up quite a bit. I read another article that references the idea about sleep cycles and how the day-night cycle is going to be different, and it's going to really mess with the astronauts.
So what will they do? Artificially turn the lights off at the correct time for the human circadian?
Yeah, that's really important. Our brains respond to light to tell us what the day time of day is, and know when to know what sleepy time, et cetera. Yeah, so that you can go a long way with just by adjusting light levels.
They can't do anything about the different gravity.
It's not like the moon. Mars is, what's the gravity on it? The moon is 1/6.
You
Mars
got one
is like
quarter,
a half or
one
something.
Quarter,
is it quarter
on Mars. Like
that? One quarter, yeah. Okay. So that's still pretty, a lot less.
That's going to be significant.
Oh, yes. And
especially if it's permanent.
They're going to need to work out all the time.
Yeah, I mean, I would think so.
Otherwise, they can come back to Earth and they would be crippled. They won't be able to handle 1G maybe for a long, long time. If ever, they could suffer permanent damage, yeah. I think it's still not clear what the effect is going to be of such prolonged low-gravity environment.
So we just grew salad on the space station.
I saw that.
Red romaine lettuce. They ate it and it was fine. They said it tastes really good. So, I mean, there's no question that they're going to have to be growing food either probably on the ship on the way to Mars, but also once they get there, that's going to be a huge part of any habitat is growing food because that not only gives you nutrition,
oxygen.
It's also oxygen. Yeah, that's like your main atmosphere recycling, you know, mechanism is going to be plants.
Let's get real about that. So first of all, if they're going to be growing plants to help feed them oxygen, they would need a massive indoor facility that would be. Now I know that they're
actually worried that if they grow enough food,
it'll be too much
oxygen. So oxygen is not going
to
be the limiting factor.
You have to
factor.
Vent some of the bad gases out. And they're trying to figure out ways of doing that.
Are you serious?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I'm totally
plants
shocked.
Plants make a lot of oxygen. Didn't you ever have one of those fish tanks where you have, like, animals and plants totally self-contained?
Right.
What do you call those?
A torture chamber. That's what I call it.
A terrarium?
No, it's a biome.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah. That's the other. And so, that's really not the hard part.
What's the hard part?
We don't know how well plants are going to grow in Martian.
No, but they say
hydroponics. Would you use hydroponics?
No, Bob. It's the light intensity difference. But I read an article on that
as
well.
You can get artificial light.
They said that they are picking plants now. They're starting to vet out plants that are going to be able to thrive in that environment. But they have to have a dual purpose. They have to be able to operate on low water and high nutrition.
And they also have to recycle all of their nutrients.
Right.
Yes.
Because they're not going to be able to just buy fertilizer and put it on the plants.
I'm scared shitless for the people that do that. It's got to be a nightmare.
That's a huge roll of the dice. Yeah. Like permanently moving to Mars and a self-sustaining colony there. It would not surprise me if the first one or two failed.
I just came up with the next SGU video.
Yeah.
Okay.
It's going to be a montage of the people prepping for getting on the spaceship, flying to, and then landing on Mars. And we're going to show the de-evolution of man as they get there, because it's going to turn into total...
The Lord of the Flies by the time they get
there. I just picture... Yes. Like one guy, this one just popped in my head, but they're on a spaceship. As soon as they shut the door, the other guy turns to the other one and he goes, "I'm gonna fucking kill you."
Right?
Space,
imagine that.
Space madness sets in early.
Yeah, like a mass murderer, like psychotic murderer gets himself on the mission, and as soon as they shut the door, he's like, "You're all mine." Like, think about it. That'd be a great movie.
He passed the screening, okay.
Isn't there somebody seriously predicting how long it's gonna take for them to all be dead for various reasons?
I've read different things.
Sure. I mean, it's...
How long do you think you would survive in a self-contained small space?
0 days. I would have a heart attack on the launch. I suffer from claustrophobia. Like I can't deal with the tight spaces and all that.
I've never heard anyone discuss using virtual reality to deal with that situation.
Oh, that's interesting. Discussed it. You and I had that conversation in 2 weeks ago.
We met nobody else besides you.
But nobody else.
I totally agree, Bob. They have to. They have to cruise when they're on. They're going to be on the ship up to 18 months or something ridiculous like that. They're not going to be.
They
able
must
to,
have thought of it because it seems like a no-brainer to me.
I totally agree. I'm sure that they're going to do it.
Sure. Why wouldn't they?
Yeah, I would last less than a day. I think also. I mean, just a few years ago, there was a bad snowstorm. I was stuck in my house for 4 days. And I was going stir crazy. I mean, I would hate to look at the same four walls
and the same like 20 people.
Yeah.
Four people.
You know, the weird things that people do. You own those things.
Yeah,
like you have to deal with everyone's idiosyncrasies and ticks and all that stuff.
Do you have to scratch that again?
Yeah.
So we often complain on the show about the unimaginative names that exoplanets have. They have these designations.
N4213B.
Yeah. Kepler-42b. Oh, that's really sexy. Yeah. Okay. So, but the International Astronomical Union, which is real, right? So this counts. This is not like the star registry, you know, where like
biased
totally
by a name of a star.
Yeah. I bought one of those, by the way.
Yeah.
I didn't know. What do you know? I'm like, this is like the beginning of the internet. I'm like, oh, cool. I can name a star, and I did it. And then I found out like years later. How much you pay for that?
you got shit.
It's registered with Fred, you know, somewhere. Yeah. But this is real. This is the international. These are the guys who demoted Pluto to a dwarf planet.
Yeah, so they have power. It's real.
Yep. They have power.
They got Mojo.
Yeah. So anyway, so they have. They are going to start naming. Actually naming some of the exoplanets.
Proper names.
Cool, actual names.
But they will also have technical designations, I'm sure, right?
Yeah, well, they'll have their catalog designation, but they'll have the names. Some of them already have sort of informal names, but they don't count yet.
Right.
But anyway, so they right now you can go to the IAU website. They have 20 exoplanets. They've already gone through the nomination phase. So each one has about 20 names, and then you could vote for the name, you know, which name you like best for each of those exoplanets.
Oh, they're not letting people pay to name it like Pepsi Planet or something like that.
Oh, corporate sponsorship for planets?
So, Steve, are the people deciding the name, or are they going to just be recommendations to the
real? Well, that's a good question. Yeah, are they going to take the vote or not? I think they probably will because they already filtered the names.
So there
were like 27,000
nominations. So here's the acceptable ones. Anyone is good.
So you can't call it Planet Dickhead or something. Right. That's out.
What's their rules? Like, what do they got going on?
I haven't really detected that they have chosen, say, a theme per system or anything, which would be a cool idea.
It would be.
It's really just names that are appropriate to that particular planet, exoplanet. So, like, for example, one of the planets is around the star Fomalhaut, which is always one of my favorite star names, and it's in the constellation Pisces. So there's a lot of fish-themed names for the planet.
Did they call one, like, SeaWorld or Waterworld?
My favorite one of that was Dagon.
Dagon?
Yeah. I know Dagon is.
Science fiction reference?
Yeah.
So, but it got me thinking, what would be... How would you name the exoplanets? Like, if they said, all right, guys, you guys are always complaining about it. Here's 20 exoplanets.
Oh, my God, would you?
Oh,
that would be the best things that could happen.
Name a planet.
Yeah, there's so many different kinds of names you can pull from. So, obviously, you know, within our solar system, the planets and Pluto are named after Roman deities, the Roman pantheon. A lot of the other dwarf planets, like Haumea, Maki Maki, those are Polynesian mythos. So mythology is cool, but you don't have to use mythology. I mean, you can use the names of astronomers and scientists. Planet
Sagan. That's a good start.
At some point in the history of humanity, there has to be a planet Sagan.
But better be.
Can we just cut to what planet really Curie? Needs to happen here?
Planet Curie.
We have to just pick awesome sci-fi
like
stuff.
Spaceship names, like sci-fi spaceships, like the Bellerophon or Enterprise.
Well, Bellerophon's a Greek mythology too, but or sci-fi planets.
Vulcan.
Like Vulcan, Tatooine.
Yeah, that's my favorite one. They got to start there. Well, yeah, they'd be easy to pick one of the desert worlds.
Arrakis.
Arrakis would be awesome.
Rigel.
Dune planet.
Any suggestions from you guys about what would be make a cool planet name?
LV-426.
That's taken.
It's not so easy when you think about it. But
No, because it has to be worthy of a fucking planet.
Yeah. Well, also in the solar system, like the moons of Jupiter.
Planet Pizza, Steve.
Planet Pizza.
Okay.
Planet Hollywood.
Planet Fitness, yes.
Planet Fitness. they're named after characters from a Shakespeare play. So literature is perfectly acceptable.
Sure. Okay.
And also we have to hit all the cultures. Like, it can't be all Occidental.
Well, how about, though, like they have themed solar systems?
Yeah.
Right?
Like, how about one solar system could be themed Sesame Street, and you could have the twin planets, Bert and Ernie, and you have Big Bird as the Jovian planet.
How bummed would you be if you're on planet Elmo? You know what I mean? Like, that's terrible.
How about a Teletub theme?
No, we're not going there. We will never visit that system.
Tinky Winky?
Tinky Winky. Don't even get going on that.
All right. Well, we'll see how that goes. We'll see. I'm definitely going to vote for my favorite planet names. So, Evan, this is a fusion reactor. There's been an update, I understand.
Fusion reactor.
5 years. We're 5 years away.
Not five to ten. Only 5 to 10. Nuclear power, the wave of the future, right? we currently do it. We do it using nuclear fission, in which we are splitting atoms, and it releases a little bit of energy, and we try our best to contain that energy so we don't have these catastrophic chain reactions that, you know, wind up, melting us down and exploding and doing all these other things. But there is another kind. There is fusion, in which you take essentially two hydrogen atoms, you slam them into each other, as hard as you can, and hopefully what you get is a helium atom. And that also produces a little bit of energy, a little bit of light.
A lot of energy.
Yeah.
And the sun is the perfect example.
So
of
we know
the,
it works.
Usually, it absolutely does work. But
the sun is a proof of concept.
Here's the it absolutely is. The problem is the temperature. You kind of need to get into the several tens of millions of degrees in order to have
pressure.
Nuclear fusion and the gravity and pressure that is involved. So that's kind of a barrier. But scientists are, in fact, working on this problem. And so here's the latest thing. We've got, thanks to our friends at MIT, advances in magnet technology. They're proposing a new design for a practical compact tokamak fusion reactor.
What's tokamak?
Tokamak means
torus.
Right.
It's a donut shaped.
Oh yeah, they've been talking about the donut shape for a long time now.
Fairly advanced, but not advanced enough to actually make it totally work.
Well, so the where we are with that is they can get to the point where some fusion is happening. But it takes more energy to make that happen than you get out of it.
Yeah, that's the problem.
Yeah, so we need to cross that magic line where we're getting more energy out of the process than we're putting in. Then it's a source of energy, right? Which is obviously the goal.
So this is a perpetual motion machine, is what you're saying.
Well, at the moment.
As long as you have fuel.
That's right. You need fuel.
So, Ed, does it work? Like, where are they at?
It's theoretical at the moment, but the prognosis looks good.
Yeah.
For this, because it doesn't require any really sort of new breakthrough is in physics in order to do this. You just have to be able to increase your magnetic capabilities, which is not an easy problem.
It's an engineering problem.
It is an engineering problem.
Yeah. Well, that's what I like about this is that it's not, they don't have to create new technology and new breakthroughs in physics. It's using the standard physics and technology that they've been using, but since the magnetic field is a lot stronger, then they can get much hotter and therefore get more energy out of it. Because just a little bit of an increase in the magnetic field strength can produce a decent amount of energy coming out.
Yeah, so I think they said if you double the magnetic field strength, you get a tenfold increase in power.
What? Output. Oh my God, that's awesome.
So even with this new design that's on the drawing board, they haven't built it, right? But they said, okay, if we can make a smaller fusion tokamak reactor with an improved magnetic field, we get the magnetic field strength up by about 20% or so, that's a significant increase in the power output. And they think, by their calculations, that brings us over the producing energy level.
Yeah, right.
So now we're producing energy rather than just absorbing. Exactly.
Right. You'll get three times the energy out as to what you put in. Yeah.
So at this point, think about how profound this whole concept is, though. Like, let's do a 30,000-foot view. According to MIT, it seems like we're really close now, and like all the talk about it in the past saying it's impossible, whatever, is gone. Now, if we're that close, why aren't world governments just going apeshit?
Yeah, I don't know. That's my question too. I mean, I think part of it is that this has been so long. The joke is that we're 30 years away from a working fusion reactor, and we always will be, because it's been, this experts have said we're 30 years away for the last 50, 60 years.
Yeah, but somebody's drawing a line in the sand here, saying it's just magnetism at this point.
Yeah, but Jay, we've discussed this on the show many times of these apparent breakthroughs and the different methods of creating fusion energy, and it's like you get so used to it.
Bob, I think your attitude sucks.
But listen to this though. This is such a game changer. Not this technology specifically. For all I know, there could be some major problems that's not going to make this work. But the country that produces a working fusion reactor, that country is going to be, their economy will improve by an order of magnitude.
It's the brass ring.
Every country will want one of your fusion reactors.
Many.
So you would be selling fusion reactors all over the place. That would be like the most hot product on the planet.
Yeah.
So that's
it's a game changer. There's no question, because it's clean, and there's no nuclear waste. The byproduct's helium. If you're fusing hydrogen. Right.
Which we need, frankly.
Yeah, so
we could use more helium.
Any radioactive stuff that comes out of it, though, the half-life is nothing compared to other stuff.
No, it's not like what we currently have to deal with.
You wonder, like, we were close to making a nuclear weapon in the 30s, 40s, and of course they had the Manhattan Project, because there was a war happening and we had to beat the Nazis.
Yeah, necessity
the Nazis, finished their weapon first, we were screwed. So there isn't that same deadline, or competition going on right now, but it does seem like we're getting to the point where, like, a Manhattan-style project to push us over the finish line might do it, you know? And it would absolutely be worth the investment. I mean, if we put $10 billion into this, that money we would get back many fold. No question. But, you know, you got to convince the right people that we're close enough that it's worth the investment. And
well, it's MIT, you know, so they have the street cred. The thing about this, though, I mean, if we really were to get there, this plays perfectly into the electric economy.
Yeah.
You know, if we're producing an unlimited amount of electricity, or, you know, we have an excess of electricity, then we can get off of oil.
Oh gosh. The greenhouse emissions will plummet. The ripple effect is tremendous. It would really change.
It's a win-win.
It would change the world.
Yeah.
Change the world. So we're step closer.
I step closer, but seriously, you know, they're saying, like, if this design works, it would take them 20 years to build it and make it actually put it into production. Mm. So, you're always going to be 20 years away from a working model from the drawing board.
Yeah.
We're at the drawing board stage, and we don't know if this is the version that's going to actually get us over the line. But so it could be, we could still 30 years away.
But we don't need to wait for any new breakthroughs. That's kind of the big point here.
Right. Bob, you're going to tell us about evolving robots.
This was pretty cool. Robots. All right, guys. So researchers have replicated natural selection using robots.
Are they sexy robots?
Well, look at the
picture. It's almost redundant.
They use what they call a mother robot to design and create her children robots.
Aww.
And then she assessed them and then created the...
That she murdered them.
No.
In a way.
Cannibalized them and made new
children. Yeah. And then created the next generation. Right. These are from researchers from the University of Cambridge in collaboration with the ETH Zurich, and it's in the journal PLOS One. So let me go into some detail. Now, the motherbot, you might think of Rosie the robot, but no, that's the motherbot right there. It's basically a robot arm. So, you know, it's not maybe what you think when you hear the term mother robot, but this was interesting because there was no human intervention at all, which is one of the defining characteristics of this. They basically just turned it on, and of course she was programmed to create these child bots and then assess and test them and then create other generations. But that was it. Once she was turned on and set loose, she was on her own. What she did was she created generation after generation of these children robots, and each generation had about 10 child bots in it. The child bots, which you can see on the table over there, they look like these little cubes. They consisted of 1 to 5 connected cubes, and each cube had a motor in it. And also in the cubes were a genome. The children actually had a genome, which was 1 to 5 genes, and in those genes were all the information to shape and construct the children and the motor commands that would go in. So that's the basis right there. Then, like natural selection, you need mutation to evolve. So they incorporated mutation just like in regular evolution. The genes could be modified, so any of the genes could be modified in some random way. Genes could be added or deleted, and then you could also have crossover, where you would take the genome from one child and cross and mix it with another child and create a new genome. Apparently incest is not a concern for these children robots. And then, whenever you're dealing with some artificial generations of organisms, you need a fitness test. That is absolutely key. You need a way to assess, all right, is this worthy of making it to the next generation or not? So the motherbot was designed to determine how fast can these children move based on their configuration, how much space they cover per unit of time. And if you were the best in your generation, you automatically got a golden ticket to the next generation. You were unmodified. But the kids that were not the best, they're the ones that were mutated in some horrific way or in some helpful way. Now the results were interesting. Obviously there were lots of design variations that the mother had incorporated into the next generation. But when you compared the last generation to the last generation had an average speed that was twice as fast as the very first generation. So there was definitely an improvement, and it was actually fairly rapid, a little bit, I think, more rapid than they even anticipated. They ascribed this to not only the fine tuning of the design parameters, because the mother had the ability to invent new shapes and new gait patterns, and they said that was one of the characteristics that made them evolve a little extra fast. So, I mean, what all this is, we're talking about evolutionary robotics, which is a really interesting discipline. You may have heard of that, but more in the context of a computer program. They actually design these things on a computer, and then you could spit out not 10 kids, but thousands of kids and have them go through millions of generations. So that's the benefit of evolutionary robotics in computers, because they can just do it so fast. This, of course, is much, much more slow. But the problem with the computer evolutionary robotics is that you have what they call a reality gap, where there would be a difference between the real world, you know, the simulated behavior and the real world behavior.
Can they fix that?
Well, now it's
better
better simulations, but also they want to kind of in the future combine these two, where you have the computer simulation will pre-select the most promising, and then you create them in real life and test them that way to get rid of that reality gap. So, sure, you can make lots of jokes about our Terminator future and how we're going to build self-evolving robots.
I was thinking,
robots.
Bob, so they set this thing up and they turn it on and go home. Yeah. They come back the next morning and they open the door and there's the liquid metal Terminator from the movie staring at them like. You shut the door.
There's Cylons in there. Yeah.
So this is interesting to me because I think evolutionary robotics is fascinating, and now to see it, you know, out of the computer and into real hardware is really interesting. But it really overturns a conception of robots as these static things that don't change, right? When you think of a robot, they don't really change in your mind. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But this is a way to actually apply evolutionary theory to the modern robots and see what happens. And they were even hinted in some of the websites I looked at that some of the designs the mother came up with, they actually said humans would not have come up with that. Yeah. I mean, she did stuff that they would never have anticipated. And they even made it seem like they said a human could not have done it, which they didn't go into detail,
couldn't the computers have predicted that though?
Perhaps. You mean
the
software?
Software.
Yes, I've heard of computer algorithms making designs for programs that are almost incomprehensible, and they do things that people, they said, no programmer would have thought to have done that type of thing.
Bob, what do you think of the anti-AI sentiment that's going on with a lot of high-end tech people like Bill Gates?
Elon Musk.
Yeah.
I'm not sure it's anti. Yeah. It's more just caution.
Well, I mean, I think, you know, I'm hearing like they're saying they don't want AI to be able to kill people or, you know, have this military aspect.
I hope they're saying out of the box.
We want AI to kill people.
And I understand you don't want a totally self-contained AI that could reproduce itself, because then we lose control over it.
Yep.
You know, I understand that. Especially, you don't want an AI that is programmed to kill people, that is also autonomous, where there's no human in the loop.
Yeah, keep a human in
gotta
the loop.
Got to keep a human in
sure.
the loop. Yeah.
Oh, they'll keep him in the loop, all right. Yeah. Come here, human.
Speaking of building stuff, Jay, so I understand.
It's not done yet.
It's not there yet. Some people have actually came up with a thought experiment. Like, what would it take to build the Death Star?
Yes. Yeah, so first off, just so everybody knows, like, I'm totally freaking out about Star Wars because the movie's coming out, and I don't know, like about a year ago, I just noticed, like, I'm getting super psyched for the movie, and my childhood, you know, love affair with it is totally rekindled.
This is kind of how we felt before the prequels came out.
Yeah, that's true.
That was a trial run.
So I'm trying to sneak in as much Star Wars stuff into the show as we possibly can.
Nice
but
shirt, Jay.
This is, right? Would you believe it if I told you I'm wearing Star Wars underwear?
Yes, I would.
Oh, absolutely.
So recently an infographic, I'll show you later. An infographic came out that has the fun of exploring, like, how much would it cost? How much would it take? You know, how much tea would you have to, you know, serve on the Death Star? They were saying, first off, that it's 1.08 times 10 to the 15 tons of steel would be required.
Why would
to
you build
it
out of steel?
Exactly. That was the first thing. Could you let me read this, maybe?
Go ahead.
He's going around. No, I thought of the same thing. Like,
what would you build it out of?
Well, I'd build that out of something that doesn't exist yet.
Carl Metal.
Well, all right, let's say we had to build it today. I mean, I agree with you that I think we couldn't build it today.
Yeah.
Is the bottom line. But if you were going to build it today, you wouldn't build it out of freaking steel.
Yeah.
I mean, well, first of all, I'm sure there would be a lot of steel in there. But then the question becomes, what kind of steel, right? Because there's different kinds of steel.
Right. How you mix
Titanium is obviously, either titanium steel or just a lot of titanium would probably be something that we would use. But we spoke a few weeks ago about the foam. Let us know if that was
that the foam stuff.
The foam metal. So you can make, so basically you're nanostructuring materials, right? So nanostructuring steel so that it's foamy, and that you end up with something that is stronger, lighter, but also is a much better radiation shield than even solid steel.
That's right.
Which of course
that
you would
cool.
need. Well, so we would need some kind of high-end material, like just foam, titanium, steel alloy, whatever, to make it
I mean,
realistic.
Radiation protection, I don't think that would be much of a problem, even if this was steel, because it's, even gamma rays aren't going to get too far through steel.
That star has a shield system.
Just have nobody living, you know, within even 100 feet of the surface, and you're
that star has a shield generator, let's not forget. Yeah, so we're really going to go there.
I don't want to even talk about what I'm going to say. I'm just going to say it, and let's move on. But there's no gravity on the Death Star.
Yeah. You know, it has you have to create an artificial.
Yeah, which we can't do. Okay.
So but if it's the size of a small moon,
wait a second,
and it's mostly metal, it would have gravity. It would have gravity.
The closer to the surface you would be, the greater the gravity would be, right?
Yeah,
now,
I
think in that article they say that it's roughly as dense as what, like a battleship. So it's not like it's going to be a solid moon-like planet. But if you were near the surface, maybe it would, and this is what, moon-sized, right? This is the size of the
small moon.
Maybe it would be, you know, a 16th Earth gravity or a 12th or something, which is not insignificant.
So they're saying that, you know, of course, with today's production, we couldn't even produce enough steel to do it.
Right. Yeah.
But they were saying that
we'd be mining asteroids.
Yeah.
No,
well, the Earth has enough for ore on it.
For how
on
many?
The surface?
For how many? No, not in surface, total.
You know, like hundreds or thousands
No, like a million.
Yeah, there's an enormous amount of steel, but it's in the core of the planet. No, we'd have to mine our own planet, so just forget about it. It's a stupid
thing. Not the core, that's ridiculous. That's what I'm saying. You have to mine that? Why would you mine the core of your planet? Mine asteroids.
I agree, yeah, but we'd have to go get them.
It would cost
a quadrillion dollars.
Oh. A quadrillion?
A quadrillion dollars. That seems low.
Did you take a check?
13,000 times the world's GDP.
13,000
That's all?
Times, yeah.
So it would take 13,000 years to build it.
If we spent 100%
of
our
100% of your resources, yes.
Yeah.
That's right.
But then you die from starvation.
All right, so then now we can get into things that maybe they were more accurate about. I think these numbers were more accurate from an estimation. Staffing it. Okay, 265,000 crew members.
Okay, that sounds about right.
Yeah, so it's a city.
Right. It's a large city.
Yeah, city.
They had 607,000 troops. 180,000 pilots and support crew, which seems legit. They have 52,000 gunners because there's people manning the surface of it everywhere, ready to shoot at rebels when they come.
Jeez.
30,000 stormtroopers, which are the elite. You know, these aren't just your.
Right. Where are these numbers coming from?
They made them up, Bob. They're just figuring out how big is it.
Where did these numbers come from?
All right. I thought maybe it came from the books or
no,
something.
No. This is a science experiment.
If you have a gun every so often, how much surface area is it? How much? You have three shifts a day. I mean, how many people would it take?
Yeah.
So you have always have every gun manned. It would take whatever.
I got it.
All right. So now they're saying though. So that's 1.1 million people on the whole thing, doing everything, support staff. And
again, there's more than that many people in Manhattan. So
yeah. Many more.
Yeah. So that's.
So how long would it take to clean the Death Star? They estimate it has 35,000 floors, an average height of 4 meters. So they're basically saying that
it would never be done. That's almost a silly question because you're going to be constantly.
That's what they're saying. And a constant cleaning would take 48 million cleaners to work full time to keep it clean. 48 million? I don't get that number, but that's
what more than the people that were there.
Yeah, that's fortunate.
So they say 33% of the American labor force would take to clean the Death Star. So they obviously need Bob's robots to just clean it up.
Yeah.
Come on, a couple of thousand Roombas going around.
11.
Didn't they have those?
They did.
Yes. They said
Chewbacca yelled at one.
Yeah. That was the first Roomba.
It was a Roomba.
And they all whistle when they work.
Yeah.
It would take Darth Vader 11.4 million years to mop the floors on the Death Star.
No. He would command 11 million brooms to just, you know,
Let's go to food.
Yeah, Mickey Mouse. Yeah.
So they would need 1.8 million tons of food every year, 68 million gallons of water every year, 1,291,000,000 cups of tea per year.
Yeah. If they swing that way.
Okay.
That's actually the food. The food is the biggest issue when you think about it because, you know, Manhattan is surrounded by farmland, you know, technically. And there are trains and trucks constantly flowing food into the city.
Yeah.
There would have to be cargo ships constantly delivering food to
Why
the Death
couldn't you
Star.
Just build
just
it
grow
in?
Grow it.
Build
Replicators.
It in. Like, what about, you know, 1,000 floors worth of
food? Well, or you would have to grow tremendous amount of food on the star.
Plenty
itself.
Of room.
But that would mean there'd be less. That actually makes sense. Then there'd be less room for people. Half the space would have to be filled
But where are the farmers? Right, there's no farmers in these.
I'm just saying. They're saying they give a dollar amount on how much it would cost for the upkeep a year. I'm sure that's, you know, part of it is,
okay. Well,
is feeding
that
many people and, you know, waste management and all that. So
how much does it cost to fire the planet killing ray? Can you imagine the requisition form for that? Yeah.
Sign here and here, initial here.
That reminds me.
It takes them months just to get the one check mark.
Oh, the planet's moved.
That reminds me on the old, I think the old Star Trek, the classic Trek, that whenever you see somebody shot with one phaser blast that was $2,000 in, or was it Voyager?
In special effects?
It was $2,000 to fire one phaser blast.
In special effects?
In special effects
cost. Oh, okay.
And if he died by two phaser blasts, it was $4,000. So that's really funny. And then, of course, nowadays it would cost pennies per laser blast, but back then it was not cheap.
Because they had it literally hand-drawn into on the film, right? Isn't that what I heard?
I think for Classic Trek, I think it might have been hand-drawn.
So we're not going to be building this anytime soon.
Hell no. Five to 10 years.
No. We're not even close. This is, you know, we're not even, technologically speaking, we're not even remotely close to being able to do anything like
this.
This
was fun.
Autoerotica. Yeah, basically. Okay.
Back to reality.
Every now and then, somebody writes an editorial, article, blog post, book, whatever, claiming that there is scientific evidence or proof for the existence of God. There are a number of different lines of arguments that people use. Going back to Aquinas, probably before him, but Aquinas was like the sort of the first famous, you know, theologian who attempted to do that. One common argument is essentially the anthropic principle. You guys are aware of the anthropic principle. The anthropic principle is essentially the notion that the universe is fine-tuned for life. Now, there's the weak anthropic principle, which says just that fact, that the universe must contain all of the necessary physical parameters for life to exist, obviously, since we are here. The strong anthropic principle says that the universe contains all of the necessary properties so that life can exist. So that, in other words, there's a design implication in it. The universe is designed to allow for life. And that's where the proof of God people go, right? So recently, this guy by the name of Eric Metaxas wrote an editorial in, I think it was the Wall Street Journal, and then produced a YouTube video, and it's been making the rounds on social media. And so I've written about his argument. So he essentially makes the following argument. First of all, he invokes the name of Sagan. So that automatically catches your attention. What he said was that Carl Sagan, in a Time article from whatever, the 1960s, argued that there are only two parameters necessary for life to exist, and that is you have a star that is putting out the correct type of light, and you have a planet within the habitable zone of that star. That's all you need. The Metaxas says, now we know that there are 200 factors that you need in order for life to exist. Where does he get that 200 factors from?
But what were they, by the way?
Well, you have to, like, read his book. You have to buy and read his book.
That's the catch.
But it was, you know, is he listing things like water and blah, 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 right?
There are multiple lists out there. I haven't seen one that includes 200. The most I've seen where they actually list all everything was 68.
Yeah, but what life are we talking about?
Exactly. So he shifted the goalpost without ever saying he was doing so, right? He went from life to a technologically advanced life, right? So, like a civilization. Yeah. Like, well, you should explicitly say you're doing that, rather than just saying, well, Sagan was wrong. We now know there's 200. Wrong. You're absolutely wrong. First of all, I think Sagan was too pessimistic. In fact, what we've learned in the last 40 years is that there's probably a lot more places for life in the universe than we had previously thought, than we thought at the time. Yeah. He was being conservative. We now know that there's a lot of exoplanets out there, and there's a lot of variability in that. Saying that an Earth-like planet at an Earth-like distance from an Earth-like star, you know, in our system, is the only place where we're going to find life, that's naive.
Yeah. Earth-like life.
Yeah, Earth-like life.
Earth-like life.
Yeah.
Well, what about this idea? If we were able, you know, just thought experiment, of course, but duplicate the Earth and the Sun.
Yeah.
And just, you know, they're in space, and there's another Earth, and, you know, you just press fast forward on time. You know, there's the idea that because the Earth and the Sun are there, that life will emerge at some point because those factors are in play?
Well, I mean, I think a lot of people believe that. A lot of scientists think that life should be common in the universe because we find organic material everywhere. Yes. Certainly the building blocks are there. It happened relatively quickly after the Earth cooled, so it couldn't have been that hard to happen. Yeah. But we only still have an N of one, so we just can't, it's hard to extrapolate from that. It could be that we could even be the only life in the universe, and of course, if that were the case, whatever that life was would probably not think that it was the only life in the universe. I think that's statistically very unlikely, but we can't say for sure that it's not true. But here's the other thing. So he did shift it to very, very Earth-like life, when in fact there could be life, like there could be life in the oceans underneath Europa. So now we have to count moons around Jovian worlds farther from, like, Europa's not in the habitable zone of our star, but because it's close to a Jovian world, it could have life.
That's a huge multiplier, right?
But wouldn't you say, though, I mean, unless we, if we found life on the moon, on that moon,
Europa,
and it wasn't based off of any kind of...
It wasn't related to us.
To us. That would be it. But what
that's
I'm thinking...
That's two. Now we have an N of two.
But what I'm... Yeah, I agree. I agree. But what I'm thinking
which
is
huge.
Because
though.
It's in our
an
solar
N of two
system.
Is much different than an N of one.
100% more.
No, no. Because that means that if it happened twice in our solar system and it was clearly an independent origin of life because it had nothing to do, no relatedness to our life, that means that we are not one in a trillion. You know what I mean? It means that it goes from we have no idea to how common life is to life is everywhere.
Yeah,
that's
right.
How profound that is.
Yeah,
that
the
would,
universe
that
is lousy with bacteria.
Got to rewrite that Bible, I suppose.
It's not just, say, on Europa that we could, which does not seem hospitable to life. There could be some theorized that there could be life on rogue planets that aren't even orbiting a star, that they're just like
and
flung
from there are trillions of them in our galaxy.
Right, and they were just flung out of their solar system and there's no star. I mean, of course you could have, you know, heat arising from the nuclear decay in their core for a time.
Mm-hmm.
But look at the Earth. There's still plenty of heat under the surface of the Earth, and it's been billions of years. Right. So you don't need the sun. I mean, sure, it would be subsurface life,
right, guys,
but it would still be life.
Curious.
Yes.
Okay. If you could control space-time right now,
mm-hmm.
would you prefer that there is alien life or that there isn't alien life?
Is.
Why?
If I could determine that question.
Yeah, like you'd get to decide if alien life is in the universe somewhere else.
Well, that's a false dichotomy.
I just want to know what, you know.
Well, the real question
you can't even ask this guy a question.
No, but seriously, what you're really asking.
Are you ever at home when you're talking to your wife and she's like, Steve, what do you want for dinner? And you're like, throw like clarifying statements at her. Joss, does this happen?
Yes.
Steve does tell Jocelyn when she commits a logical fallacy during a marriage argument.
He says you love when he does
just
that.
Just answer the question, Steve, just for fun. Would you?
No, but I'm just saying that what you're really asking is how densely populated the universe is with life. Because you could answer yes to that question. Okay, there's life in, you know, one other galaxy on the other side of the observable universe. That's
okay.
Effectively not being life. Or is there life in Alpha Centauri right
okay.
next door? Mm-hmm. Those are two very different things.
What would
things.
You prefer?
I would prefer that there is life in the universe, but there's enough of a buffer that we don't have to worry about,
about them coming to us and squishing us.
I think to sharpen your answer.
Which is why I was...
Okay, I got you.
Clarifying.
To sharpen your answer,
qualifying.
I agree exactly with you, but to sharpen it... to give us enough time to develop super awesome nanotechnology so we could protect ourselves.
But they
ourselves.
Would have the same time, though. That's the problem.
And they would have had it a million years ago.
Because think about it. How could we ever really trust any aliens, ever?
Right.
You can't. We barely can get along on our own planet.
I think it's important that we have that, you know, you can't go faster than the speed of light and that we're really far away from any potential other life. Because you think about it, you know, it's the Fermi paradox. Like, why aren't they here?
Right.
Like, if you think about it, you know, even if... one civilization arises per galaxy, you know, how often would that happen? It would take them 10 million years to explore every planet in their galaxy. They should be here, right? The bottom line is by every reasonable calculation. But whatever, they're not here. I think part of that is because it's really, really hard to travel long distance through space. I think that's a good thing. Because otherwise, how easy would it be for one civilization to build Cylons and that's it? They rule the whole universe.
Well, that's just it. An advanced civilization is going to develop robots.
Yeah, even
to
if
go
we
and
don't screw up, somebody
things,
somewhere it. Is going to screw up and build Cylons.
Yeah, yep. or think about it, like our the singularity, and if we come up with artificial intelligence, and it might be something that our society created, our civilization created, that takes over the universe. So
the other point I want to make about this is. So the other sort of flaw, the other logical flaw that Metaxas and others like him are making is the lottery fallacy, right? Where he's saying that what are the chances, you know, the chances that life arose on Earth are so remote. Well, that's like saying that the chance of, you know, John Smith winning the lottery is really remote. You're right. But the chance of somebody winning the lottery is actually a guarantee. It's pretty certain. So the other sort of analogy that people have used, I forget who used this at first, but it's perfect. It's like a puddle of water marveling at how perfectly shaped the whole is to itself, thinking that the whole was formed to fit it, rather than it is forming to fit the whole. We evolved to find the Earth comfortable, yeah. Right? So there could be an alien in another solar system in an environment that we would find horrifically hostile. Yeah. And this alien's thinking to himself, this is a perfect day in paradise. The acid levels in the atmosphere are just perfect. The hydrogen content is right where we like it. You know, all three suns are blazing away. This is perfect. It's just below boiling, right where I like it. And what are the odds that the planet, that this planet would have the perfect conditions for life?
Depends on their Bible.
Well, Steve, according to Star Trek, almost every planet is breathable.
Yes.
Right. Has the exact
1G gravity.
1G, thank you.
Gravity. Yeah. One atmosphere, yeah. 23% oxygen.
And everyone speaks English.
Yeah, that's right. Like, that Spock speaks perfect. Well, his mom, he's half human. I get that, right? Never mind.
The Klingons.
So, we will find, I think, that as soon as we encounter any aliens, all human science fiction will be instantly obsolete.
Made to look stupid.
Made to look stupid. Yeah. Made to look quaint. And like, oh, it's like when we invented airplanes, all the flying machines that predated actual airplanes looked quaint.
I just hope they don't have like crazy tentacles and all that stupid stuff.
Oh, they will.
They'll have something we don't even have a word for. You know,
it'll be
an analogy.
It'll be like a
we'll have an analogy for what it is. But, yeah.
I don't know. There's some good hard science fiction out there that's very creative.
There is.
Well, it's not like we don't get
tubes
physics.
Of wax
it's not
and
like,
stuff, yeah.
You know, I wouldn't be surprised if they're bipedal.
Well, yeah, this was a panel yesterday, if anybody was there, about what alien life would look like. And there are some interesting, again, everything is speculation. My sense is, when you think about it, think about all the wacky life on Earth.
Yeah.
You know?
Oh my gosh, we're still discovering new stuff.
We're one tiny little twig of one branch, you know, of one section of the tree of life on Earth. Most life on Earth looks nothing like us.
Yeah, that's right.
So why would life on another world look anything like us? It makes no sense whatsoever.
I think aliens are going to look like my mother-in-law.
You think so?
Yeah.
Whoa.
That's as good a theory as any. All right, let's move on.
She clearly doesn't listen to the show.
So.
Logic.
Bob, tell us about some recent examination of the history of sunspots.
Yeah, the
this is exciting, trust me.
The long-documented history of sunspots has been recently recalibrated to reveal that the past 300 years is actually very remarkably consistent, much more consistent than they had ever thought. Observing sunspots, I didn't know this. Did you know, Steve, that observing sunspots is the longest ongoing scientific experiment?
I did know that.
Oh, I'm not surprised.
Oh, really?
Like, well, okay, how far back we talk?
Like 400 years at least. Now, if you go back into the history of sunspot observations, you have, in the late 1600s to the early 1700s, you encounter something called the Maunder Minimum. This was a period of time spanning decades where there wasn't a lot of sunspots. So there was a period of time where there were very, very few sunspots for decades, and that actually was also a period of time where the winters were incredibly harsh. So that reinforced the idea that sunspots correlates to the weather on Earth. And then over in the past few hundred years, though, there's been this consensus towards an upward trend of solar activity that some people actually refer to as the modern grand maximum. So they believe that we are in a period of time in the past century or two where solar activity is just getting worse and worse and worse. And of course, when they...
Meaning increased.
Yes. Yes, increased. And, of course, there are people that think, well, that's the cause of climate change. It's obviously the sun. But actually, there's a discrepancy. I didn't know that there's two ways that they count sunspots.
It's never simple.
It's right. It's always another layer as you dig deeper. There's two methods that they use to count sunspots. One is the international or Wolf sunspot number. They look at individual sunspots and also kind of how they're grouped together. There's also the group sunspot number, and they look at groups. And those two, they each count sunspots and they each plot how many sunspots there are, and they have not agreed for many, many decades.
So those two groups hate each other?
They do not like each other.
They wrestle, they have like robot wars against each other.
Especially the late 1800s and the middle 1950s, they had wide discrepancies. So what science...
I have to pause though and say the thing is that what's interesting is that as you study science, And really try to understand what's happening behind the curtain, you know, not just reading the pre-digested press releases, but actually, yep. you know, talking to scientists or reading technical papers, you realize, first of all, that it's always more complicated than you think. However complicated you think it is, trust me, there's at least another layer there.
That applies to my marriage.
Unless you're on the cutting
edge. Unless you are on the cutting edge. Unless you are one of the researchers, internationally world-known, cutting-edge researcher in that area where you are the complexity. But unless you're there, it's more complicated than you think.
And even if you're there, it still is more complicated.
Yeah, but at least you know.
It could be.
But anyway, the other thing is that no measurement is simple. You know, measurements all require that you make some choices about exactly how you're defining and measuring things. So like even with sunspots, and until I read this news article, I never thought about it. I naively, even though I know this in broad principle, it just didn't occur to me, I would think somebody just counts sunspots. But you think about, well, yeah, how big does it have to be to right. count as a sunspot? What if two are connected to each other?
How close
is that one spot or is it two? And if you're saying that they're two, how close are you going to take a little bump as an extra spot, or is it part of just one bigger spot? There's all kinds of choices that you have to make in order to come up with a way of counting the spots.
How about this?
No objective right answer.
I think
it's
there
how
is.
You define it.
But I think there is. What if you could somehow determine how much of the face of the sun that you were looking at
area.
Is occluded by a sunspot?
Yeah.
But that's still a choice.
Right.
That may
it's
be
less
a very,
of a
it may be very quantifiable, but that right. doesn't mean it's not a choice, because the question then becomes is, why is that an important measurement? So this comes up all the time too. Like, this is a completely right. different issue, but this is a tangent, but I think it's worth pulling out of this story. Like, for example, there were creationists who were saying, like, how similar is human DNA to chimp DNA? There's no objective answer to that question. It comes down to how are you making the comparison.
Right.
And there's no one right way or one better way or one more quantitative way. It all depends on what your question is. Because the way you make the comparison will address different issues. So my question to you then is, what question are we trying to answer by counting the amount of the surface of the visible surface of the sun that's covered by sunspots versus the number of different sunspots? Are they telling us anything? Are they telling us different things about sunspot activity? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So there's nothing objective about it.
You need to stop all this science stuff and just believe.
Yeah.
Just believe in sunspots. They're
that's
there,
a lot
man.
Easier. It's a lot
They're
easier.
They're there.
No, but this is the critical lesson in this, is that there's choices we make. It's not just that we're measuring something. So obviously we like it to be objectively quantifiable, but also it has to be attached to some kind of meaning. Who cares how many sunspots
but
there
don't
are?
Sunspots, aren't they indicative of something?
That's
that they
the whole
mean
point.
Something?
Is it, what's it indicative of? And what's more indicative of that thing? The number of spots
right.
or the amount of surface area. So it's not objectively better unless you have it tied to some outcome.
Right.
Right?
Right.
To something else that you're trying to infer.
Steve, you seem a little bitter. What's going on here?
Not bitter.
It's passion.
It's scientific passion. SP, baby.
I mean, it actually is. It is important, actually, because the number of sunspots, however you calculate that, can tell you different things about the solar dynamo that's going on underneath them, space weather and climate. So it is important that we know this type of thing.
Do sunspots allow us to predict things? Right? So let's say that your theory or the idea of how much of the sun's surface is now blotted out by a sunspot. Whatever. It's just a lower temperature area.
The risk of CMEs, of a coronal mass ejection.
Right? Okay. So
right.
we know that there's a correlation between those. Okay.
Yeah.
So, you know.
Yeah,
so that's
useful information.
Yeah.
And then also, even knowing that there isn't a correlation to weather, that's an important piece of information
right.
too,
sure.
right?
Understanding
that's
global
actually,
warming and other things.
That's the point of this news item.
Right. So what they did was they looked at these two different ways to count sunspots, and they tried to recalibrate them in a way where they would agree. And they did find some weird things, like you would have a scientist who, over the course of his career counting sunspots, his eyesight would be failing, so that would affect how accurate his assessment was of how many sunspots.
Yeah, his actual, that one guy who, like, documented a 30-year period, and the sunspots were strangely decreasing over the course of his life.
His
it was all an artifact of his eyesight.
Right.
Yeah,
Bob,
fascinating.
Have they determined which of the two methods is a better predictive model? Isn't that the way to do it?
Well, one of the end results...
what they were doing here.
Yeah. What they wanted to do was to get them to agree. Because there are two different ways to count sunspots. Both of them are valid. They wanted to get them to agree. So what they did is they found a major calibration error in the group sunspot number. So they fixed that. So now they agree. And that is the result that I mentioned when I began this, is that they realized that over the course of 300 years, solar activity has not been increasing, but it's been consistent the past 300 years.
Good, okay.
So that means that this, what did I call it? The modern grand maximum was wiped away. It is actually not there now. It was an artifact of this group number here. And so that means that the past 300 years, if it's been consistent, that means that you cannot ascribe climate change to increase solar activity.
Right. So essentially, now, these two groups just hugged it out and they're all good.
Absolutely. So that kind of pulled the rug out from under climate deniers, because they cannot really look at the sun and say it's all because of the sun anymore. But who here thinks that that's going to actually stop them from
complaining?
Say of
that
course,
that's,
nobody.
That's contrived, and that's
this is all just a liberal conspiracy.
Convenient redefinition.
Yes.
Clearly.
Absolutely. I'm sure they would say, a lot of them will say that very, very thing. Yeah. So
It's interesting. But I mean, you think sunspots, it's not that exciting, but it really is just...
Well, with climate change, it is...
And it has a very specific implication.
Absolutely.
I don't know, Steve. I mean, I wouldn't call it exciting. I would say there is some intrigue. It's a little interesting, but...
That was intriguing.
Star Wars is exciting. Han Solo's DL-44 blaster is exciting.
I like sunspots. Okay, it's that time in our show for science or fiction.
It's time for science or fiction.
The way the game works, for those of you who may not be familiar, is I'm going to read you three science news items or facts. Two of them are real, and one of them is not real. It's fake. It's a lie. I'm going to lie to you on one of these three items.
Steve, I have a great idea.
Yeah.
One of you gets to play with us.
What?
Oh, my God.
Come on.
All right.
Joe!
I'll share my mic with
Excellent.
You.
So, for this science or fiction, we have a special audience guest member. Tell us your name and tell us a little bit about yourself. Which means tell us how much you love our show.
Oh, there we go. My name is Joe Robertazzi. I love the show. I work for Patchogue Metro School District as a computer aide. And that's what I do, and I listen to Skeptic's Guide when I work.
Yeah. Dynamite.
He listens to multiple episodes a day.
Yeah.
And he's wearing a Carl Sagan t-shirt. That's very important. That's probably why Jay picked you.
Falsely attributed quote, billions and billions.
Yeah. That's okay.
Yeah. We all love it.
We know what that is.
Tell us a little bit more about what it is exactly you love about the show.
And he says, my friend Jessica Donahue.
The one giggling throughout the show?
Yes, exactly. She got me into the Skeptic's Guide.
I thought she really liked our jokes.
I used to be, like, back when I was a teenager, I'm 29 now, truther and really into religion and stuff like that, and I realized as I looked, some things just didn't seem right, and then I was just like, wow, this is really anti-Semitic? What's going on here? So that made me look more into it, and then when we became friends, she's a field biologist, works for the Nature Conservancy, so scientist, you know. So that helped a lot to understand. And then she's like, you really need to listen to the Skeptic's Guide because it's amazing. And Steve is probably the smartest person I've ever heard in my life.
Oh, now you're
never send you your $5.
So like Ed and Lorraine Warren said to us, actually Lorraine Warren, she said to us when we were investigating them, they were the famous ghost hunters in Connecticut. Lorraine said to us at one point, what happened to you boys?
Oh,
was it the science? We were like, yes.
Oh,
science.
Oh, my God. So I have to watch those movies that are based on them now with my friends, and they're like, oh, my God, is this real? Like, oh.
Yeah,
and then I'm
real
like,
bullshit.
Yeah, exactly.
The real fiction.
I'm like, I'll tell you about it, and Lorraine Warren, like...
They were the most unimpressive people I've ever met. The fictionalization of them in the movies is so funny to us now because we've experienced them firsthand. They're just like this old cranky couple that was just so clueless. It was really unbelievable.
Yeah,
and then they're these epic scholars in the movies. Like, come on, it's so divorced from reality.
Like the video that they show in there is like, oh, look at this exorcism where the guy's face changes and everything. It's like, if you had proof like that, I think many more people would be, you know.
They never volunteer that stuff.
They actually told us about this time where they had this news team on an investigation with them, and they had like poltergeist movie level stuff happening. And then, you know what happened?
They taped over it.
Oh gosh. Oh, the smoking gun?
Yeah. Oh, no.
What are the chances of that happening?
Yeah, actually, no. They actually said that to us. All
right. They put a little piece of scotch tape on that square to, you know, to tape
anyway,
over.
All right, so science or fiction. There's a theme to this science or fiction. The theme is exoplanets. We were just talking about exoplanets. So these are three things about exoplanets that we have discovered.
See, did you expect everyone in the audience to go,
a little.
Exoplanets. A little bit. Did you pick that up? Like, a little disappointed.
There was no audible gasp.
He's going to gasp.
He gives a shit.
He's
going to
add a gasp.
I have gasp. Which ahead in the post. All right. Here's the first one. Exoplanet PSR B1620-26B. Gotta love it.
That proves our that goes right to our point from earlier in the show.
It's estimated to be 13 billion years old and orbits a white dwarf and a pulsar.
That's a pretty busy solar system right there.
Yeah. FW Tauri B is the only circumtrinary exoplanet discovered. I'll define that for you.
Please do.
Yeah. So
you don't have to.
Bob and I are good.
If a planet orbits two stars within its orbit, that's circumbinary. Yeah. So this would be orbiting three stars within its orbit, as opposed to another one in the system but being farther out from
it.
That's a wild ride.
Okay.
And GU Piscium B is 2,000 AUs from its parent star and has an orbital period, which means a year, of 163,000 years. One of these is fiction. At the live events, what we're going to do is I'm going to poll our live studio audience, get your opinion. You'll answer by clapping. What I'm going to do is I'm going to do this, and you're going to one clap right when I drop my hand. And then we'll see what you think.
All right, but they're clapping to the one they think is the fiction.
Clapping to the one you think is the fiction, and then we'll get expert advice from our panel of skeptics, and then we'll see if they changed their mind, and then I'll do the reveal. Okay, so here we go. If you think that the 13 billion year old exoplanet is the fiction, clap. One clap. Try it again.
The guy sitting next to him was like, "What clap, dude? What are you doing?
You ruined the whole thing."
That was awesome.
You're a new audience. That was practice. Ready? If you think it's a fiction, clap. Good enough.
We got it.
We get the point.
If you think the circumtrinary planet is the fiction, clap. A little bit more. And if you think the planet with 163,000 year is the fiction, clap. Okay, so that's a pretty good division. I thought there was a little bit of an excess for the middle one for number two, but Joe wants to start with
the course, because I'm a guest row.
Hey.
Guest, you get to tell us. Give us your analysis. Which one do you think is the fiction?
Can I say an answer and then GWB it later?
No, you gotta commit. Okay. Put your nickel back. You gotta put your nickel.
Nice try.
Yeah. And Bob's been doing terrible this year.
Really?
You don't want to go with Bob this year.
Well, the previous Bob years, yes.
Let's see. It's estimated to be 13 billion years old and orbits a white dwarf and a pulsar.
For reference, the universe is 13.7 billion years old.
That's pretty old then.
Yeah,
let's go with that one. That seems crazy.
That was a little crazy. It's fiction.
Yeah.
All right.
Well, so I was thinking about that, Steve, but that's still a lot of time. You know, 13 billion years, but the universe is 13.7, so it had 0.7 billion years for a planet to arise. Damn. That's a lot. It's still a lot of time, though. I'm just going to cut to the chase, and I think the 163,000 year orbit is way too much. So, oh shit. All right, I'll say that's the fake.
All right, the 163,000 years. All right, Evan?
One of the methods by which we find the exoplanets is the disk moving across what appears to move across the surface.
The transit method.
The transit method across the sun or the star. A planet that takes 163,000 years to do that, if you have to catch it right at that moment. So that doesn't mean that was the method, you know, obviously used. That would sort of eliminate, I think, the possibility of using that method. There are other methods. That is a freaking long time, though. The other one about the three star system. Boy, how are they able to?
We have to name Triskelion, right?
Yeah. Triskelion. Yeah.
That's right.
It's either that one or the 163,000 years. I'm thinking. Well, gosh, I'll agree with Jay that it's the 163,000 year one. Even though there are other methods for finding these exoplanets, I just think that that's too far out. We probably haven't discovered any exoplanets that far away from their star.
Okay, Bob.
Yeah, the first one that leaped out at me was the 13 billion year old exoplanet. That just seems just too old. But that's too weird. That's what I think you want me to think. And sometimes that's all I have got to go on, so I'm going to not choose it because of pretty much that reason alone.
Maybe I want you to think that I want you to think that.
that leads to madness when I go down that route. So the second one, the circumtrinary, oh man, that one's kind of tough. I could see a trinary star system with an exoplanet around maybe the outer one, but orbiting around all three, that's a problem, but not as much of a problem as GU Piscium. That's how you pronounce it.
Piscium. Because it's like Pisces.
I'm assuming. I agree with Evan. I think the real Achilles heel to that one is the 2000 AU. I mean, if you're looking at the transit method, it's going to be too far away. If you're looking at what's the other method, the gravitational perturbance of the star, mm-hmm. that's going to be too far away for that as well.
Don't forget sunspots, Bob.
So I think that's what kills that one. So I could be wrong, but I'm going to say the 2008, the 163,000 year one.
That feels good.
Fiction.
Wow.
So
thanks, guys.
Welcome to the show, Joe.
The three rogues all think that the 163,000 year planet is the fiction, and our guest rogue thinks that the 13 billion year old planet is a fiction.
Wait, do you think you want to change your mind?
Yeah,
well,
definitely.
Too late. Yeah. Let's see if you influenced the audience. We're going to do the single clap again. If you still think that the 13 billion year old planet is the fiction, clap. If you think that the circumtrinary planet is the fiction, clap. And if you think that the 163,000 year old planet is, or its orbital cycle is the fiction, clap. So definitely an influence. Definitely influenced people away from the middle one. Let's take these in order. So we'll test our guest rogue first.
Oh, man.
Exoplanet PSRB1620-26b is estimated to be 13 billion years old and orbits a white dwarf and a pulsar. So that would make it a circumbinary star.
Yes, it would.
Planet,
that's
rather.
Correct.
Circumbinary. Yeah. So you think that's fiction. The rogues think that one is correct. Some of the audience think that one is fiction. And that one is science.
Oh,
that's pretty cool.
That's an old planet. Huh? That's got to be. Is that the oldest planet we've discovered?
That is damn old. I don't know why. So the reason it can be so old is because it's in a globular cluster.
Of course.
Of course.
What is
that? Why didn't I think of that?
Are really old. That's
yes,
why.
They're the oldest systems.
So you have a spiral galaxy like the Milky Way, and then like a hum of bees, or whatever, around the center is, or these globular clusters, which are exactly what they sound like, a glob, sort of tightly packed stars orbiting around the center of the galaxy. And they actually come up out of the plane of the galaxy, you know?
Like hundreds of thousands of stars.
And
more.
They tend to be really old, like all this, there's no more star formation than all the stars are very old, so it makes perfect sense.
Yeah.
And both of the stars, of course, are very old too. Like a white dwarf and a pulsar are both the remnants of larger stars. So they're really old as well. What's interesting is that this planet survived, you know, throughout the whatever novas these stars went through. It could have been captured later. You know, it's a lot of stuff.
I would think, because otherwise a pulsar is a remnant of a supernova and a white dwarf is not. But still, it must either have a very distant orbit or it was captured.
This is 5,600 light years from Earth, this system. This planet's mass is about 2.5 that of Jupiter, 2.5 Jupiter, so that's pretty big. It's a Jovian or a large gas giant. It's about 23 AU from that AU is an astronomical unit. That is the average distance from the Earth to the Sun.
93 million miles.
It's 23 times the distance from its parent star as the Earth is from the Sun on average. So that's about as far away as Jay's favorite planet, Uranus, is from the star.
So it could have I guess it could have survived a supernova at that distance.
Yeah, so it's far enough outward. Yeah, it could have. And sometimes also, like, when stars expand and whatnot, we're still not sure about this, but it's possible that planets may migrate away from their star.
Well, yeah,
you know, they could survive that way.
The sun's losing mass at some point.
It loses mass, so this planet migrates away. So it could be out at a safe distance. Also, you know, who knows? It could have been even bigger, and some of its outer layers were blown away. Yeah. Let's go to the second one. FW Tauri B is the only circumtrinary exoplanet discovered. All of the rogues think that this one is science. The majority of the audience, especially after their expert influence, you definitely allowed them to influence you away from this one. I just want to make that clear.
Uh-oh.
Because this one is the fiction.
Oh, I almost picked it.
Damn.
This one is the fiction.
As
I know, there are no circumtrinary planets that we exoplanets. Not that they're impossible. We've discovered lots of circumbinaries. So first of all, most of the points of light that you look at when you look up at the sky, most of those are multi-star systems. They're not single stars. And in fact, if you have even a low-powered telescope, even binoculars, and you look at those points of light, you'll see a lot of them separate into two stars. You can actually see that there are multiple stars in those systems. So I think it's like half, right? Half of them are multi-star systems. Now that we're taking a really close look at it and starting to flesh out these exoplanetary systems, we just talked on the show, in fact, recently about the first system discovered with four stars in it. There's a close two stars that are very close. They're so close to each other that they're actually sharing their atmosphere. They're actually not completely separated from each other, like whizzing around each other very, very closely. Other times the stars could be very, very far away. And planets can be orbiting really in any, we've found them. We didn't know if we were going to find this because you can't really computer model this because, we don't have the equations. Once you throw a third gravitational body into it, we don't have the math to predict how it's going to behave. So we really didn't know. And in fact, it turns out, we find planets orbiting two stars, planets orbiting within every configuration you can imagine, we're pretty much finding. But I don't think this certainly isn't one. FW Tauri B is a circumbinary star. It's not a circumtrinary. What is unique about FW Tauri B, I almost use this as a real one, but what is unique about it is that it's a circumbinary, and the two stars that it orbits, that are both within its orbit, are separated by 11 AU. So it's the biggest separation between two stars within a planet's orbit.
Okay.
I didn't know if you would be impressed by that, but that's
impressive.
Do they have sunspots?
I would imagine.
Oh, that's so cool.
What did you say? What was that again, Evan? Sunspots. Oh.
All right. All of us means that...
It's a new spot.
JU Pisham B is 2,000 AU from its parent star and has an orbital period of 163,000 years. Is science. Now, I know what you all did. You all had the same exact reaction I did. The first thing you did was you went right to Kepler's equations.
Yes.
And you calculated if that makes any sense. If a 2,000 AU distance would calculate out to 160,000 year period. Of course, you'd have to know the mass of the star and everything, but whatever. Anyway, the point is, the farther away you get from the star that you're orbiting around, the slower you go in your orbit,
yes,
right?
Yes, that's right.
Kepler. Right. So like Mercury is whizzing around really fast, Jupiter slower, Pluto even slower.
Dwarf
like,
planet.
Yeah. So that gets, what's Pluto's orbital period? 263 years? That's off the top of my head. Something like that.
I think you're right.
Yeah, but what I thought was, that seems like it would be so far away that it couldn't even be captured.
Couldn't detect it.
Well, but apparently it is. Yeah. Apparently it is. So that's probably at the limit, you know, of what a star can actually hold on to a world. So this is...
Well, wait a second. What about the Oort cloud of comets? They're like 2 light years out.
Yeah.
How many AU is 2 light years?
I don't know. That's a good question. Do that calculation, Bob. So this planet is 9.13 Jupiters, in mass. It's 153 light years away. Not that far away. Now, this also has another distinction. This planet has another distinction, but it's related to this. And that is, its apparent separation, the planet from the star, is 42 arc seconds. That's the largest separation of any exoplanet from its star as seen from the Earth. It makes sense because it's so far away. So that also tells you about how maybe we found it. Certainly it wasn't the transit method, and it wasn't the perturbation of the orbit, because
the
period
was
too long.
So we got that
direct
part right.
Direct observation. It was found with direct observation.
Direct observation.
That's so far. There's also microlensing. Don't forget microlensing. But it's so far from its star.
Microlensing of a planet?
Yes.
Thing's moving
slow. There are putative exoplanets discovered with microlensing. They haven't been confirmed.
Wow.
But anyway, that just to throw that in there. But if the planet is big enough and far enough away from its star that we can block out the light from the star and sort of still see the planet, that you can observe an exoplanet through direct observation. That's how we found this one. So it was neither of the two methods that they thought were so implausible. But it's a big planet far from its star. That makes it optimal for direct observation. So that was the other method that was used. Isn't that cool? And the star that it orbits around has sunspots.
Oh my God.
That isn't that awesome.
You just blew my mind.
Yeah, just at the back of your head.
Sorry about that.
back into the left.
And this is just scratching the surface. There are so many cool exoplanets out there. I mean, this.
Oof. We should be naming them.
We should.
We should. Cool
giving
names.
Them names that are as cool as they are.
So, yeah, it's less. 2000 AU is less than the Oort cloud.
Is a little bit closer. Yeah, so it should. So it should. Yeah. Not a problem. Right. That's a problem. Okay, well,
should we cut our guest loose?
Yes, thank you so much.
Thank you, guys. It's amazing.
Thanks, Joe.
All right, so Evan, you're going to close us out, as you always do, mm-hmm. at least for the last year, with a quote.
And appropriate to the convention we're at, here's the quote. It speaks to some basic human needs that there is a tomorrow. It's not all going to be over in a big flash and a bomb, that the human race is improving, that we have things to be proud of as humans. No, ancient astronauts did not build the pyramids. Human beings built them because they're clever and they work hard. And Star Trek is about those things. Gene Roddenberry.
Awesome. Thank you all for joining us for this special episode of The Skeptic's Guide. Thanks to my fellow rogues for joining me here. Thanks to Carl Fink for inviting us to LICon. And until next time, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe.
The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at theskepticsguide.org, where you will find the show notes as well as links to our blogs, videos, online forum, and other content. You can send us feedback or questions to info@theskepticsguide.org. Also, please consider supporting the SGU by visiting the store page on our website, where you will find merchandise, premium content, and subscription information. Our listeners are what make SGU possible.